Brigadier Calvert, Reel 16.
I repeat, I had some wounded in the operations crossing the Irrawaddy. We couldn't carry them along with us, and we had been instructed as to what to do. We tended them. I had a medical officer, Captain Rao, RAO, Indian Medical Service, who was a very good man. And we then went to the nearest village. I got the headman of the village, and with the Burma Rifle interpreter and Captain Rao, we asked them to look after our wounded and hand them over to the Japanese medical if they came along. Now, I wrote a note to the commander of the Japanese saying, I leave you these men who have been wounded, fighting for their king and country.
This was a note in English, was it?
Yes. Just as you are fighting for your king and country. They have fought courageously, and I'm sure that with your Bushido, you will look after them and tend them. And then I said my best wishes and signed myself. The Burma Rifles made a translation of this in Burmese, and I felt that the Japanese, when they got these people from the Burmese, the Burmese villagers, all knowing what had been said, they would look after them. And it did turn out that they were looked after very, very well, and to such an extent they said, whether this is true or not, I spoke to them after the war, they looked after them so well that some of the other prisoners of war thought that they had given away secrets in order to be looked after so well. But I can guarantee they knew no secrets. And this idea, which was Wingate's, I can say worked. Let me stop, pause a moment. I'll just mention one more point about the first operation. There's probably very much more I could say and should say, but I'm trying to add on to what has already been said. First of all, say that our radio worked well, our air supply was excellent, our mules were good and very tasty when we ate them, and we were always short of rations, but that was because of the arduousness of the campaign, and there were places where we couldn't get air supply, and so we all came out about 3 or 4 stone lighter than when we went in. I want to say one point on the subsequent report and its distribution. Wingate wrote his report, and I was asked to make the map of our routes, which I did. This was after we got back to India, and it was bound well by the Indian Army Ordnance Corps. What do I say? As you know, as I correct that, the Ordnance Survey, or Ordnance Survey, I think it's, they made the maps, and they're friends of mine there, and they printed the report, so it looked very smart. This was distributed to certain people by Wingate and was sent home to Mr. Amory, who was in, one or two other people. I don't know how he got it. It caused a flurry, and the Indian army ordered its withdrawal and then made certain blackouts. Now, the reason the Indian army got so het up, the reason they said was that we had mentioned the names of officers who had behaved badly. And I think that the main ones, Wingate had said, he just said it by the way, he didn't sort of single them out, were these two Gurkha column commanders who had, he didn't say that, but who had refused to learn from him how to operate in the jungle, and both of whom were overrun by the Japanese. And because of their carelessness and lack of following this training, and I think both of whom were killed, and the Indian Army reckoned that one shouldn't criticize an officer after he was dead. Well, the point of Wingate's report was to teach others. Anyway, they withdraw them, and they struck out in deep black those points and some other points which I didn't see were particularly important. This fact that this, because they didn't get back all these reports, and the fact that the reports were finally issued with these great black marks across them, of course, added to the curiosity of everybody and increased the importance of the report. Now, I'll now go on to, after our leave, General Wingate asked me to go to see 111 Brigade. Whilst we were in operating in Burma, General Wavell, who was still Commander-in-Chief, had ordered the raising and training of another brigade, and they chose General Lentaine of the Gurkhas. From Indian Army headquarters at Delhi, he was told that he must make this an Indian Army affair, and that he must show that the Indian Army could do just as well as a British Army officer. There was this jealousy between British service and Indian service, dating back to Kitchener's day and to the operations abroad of the Indian Army in Mesopotamia and in East Africa. There had been an inquiry after the Mesopotamian debacle, when the army was captured at Kut el Amara, and this was carried out by the British War Office, who said that the Indian Army should never be allowed to wage war beyond its boundaries, because it was incapable of doing so. This cut the Indian Army to the quick, and also the Quetta Staff College. And it, well, the truth is that some British Army officers were very good, and when they came out, others didn't know the terrain and were not particularly good. Same way with the Indian Army, they tended to be rather closed shop and inwardly looking, and they hadn't absorbed a lot of the ideas which were going on in the rest of the world. Result is, but it did cause and maintain bad feeling between British and Indian Army officers for a long time to come. I may say that in from a historical point of view, that this sort of bitterness or rivalry between two armies has occurred very many times in military history. The Germans who fought on the Eastern Front despised the Germans who fought on the Western Front in both world wars. In fact, they couldn't be put in the same barracks together. In the same thing occurred in the Russian army, and it, to a certain extent, it occurred in the forgotten army of Burma and the British Army of the Rhine, which was called or BLA, Britain's Liberation Army, which was named in India as Britain's Luxurious Army. For instance, an example was we were low priority, and we did not get penicillin, whereas the British forces in Europe and the Middle East got penicillin. This sort of thing embittered people a lot. So there are these rivalries which occur, and I suppose one must just take them for granted. Anyway, I was sent down to Lentain. I found him really standoffish. And I came out, I'd given up some of my leave to go down there, and I was willing to be helped, be of assistance wherever I could, and I talked to him in the mess. I wasn't allowed to talk to any of the officers, and the only person I did have a long talk to was Jack Masters, who took over from Lentain after Lentain had failed in the field of battle, and he lapped up everything and asked me questions and talked to me for about the 2 days I was there. But I felt I was rather spurned and went away after 2 days. I think this was, there were sort of instructions which would come to Delhi, which did not further the war effort. I can give another example on the second Wingate operation. After one of my colonel of the 6th Gurkha Rifles had been sent out because he'd got a very bad heel and couldn't march properly, I promoted his second in command to be battalion commander, Freddie Shaw. And one day Freddie Shaw came along with some letters which he'd received from senior officers in Delhi, telling him, to an extent, rather, not to obey orders. And he must avoid all casualties and not get, and not do this, not do that. It is an extraordinary thing. I don't know whether that occurs in the British Army or any other armies, but I think it's absolutely astounding that senior officers can write to junior officers in the field and tell them to do things to a large extent disobey orders. Fortunately, Freddie Shaw was a very, very honest and open chap, and I told him to tear them up, and that was that. But I think it is absolutely disgraceful. These are things which we can talk about now after 40 years, and so that it doesn't occur again. Just imagine somebody from the senior general who had been in the Dragoon Guards writing to the CO, or writing even to one of the company commanders and saying, don't do, no, it's more the CO, don't do this and don't do that, don't fight. Your job is to be a cavalry officer, and don't let yourself be embroiled in any major battles, because otherwise you'll have too many casualties. I did have one example of this when I was commanding the Special Air Service Regiment in Europe. The Special Air Service Regiment had done very well in Normandy and so on, and a number of these officers had been decorated, but they thought that the war had finished for them. At that time, especially during the Battle of the Bulge, the British Army was very short of officers and men, and these SAS officers, who'd operated for many months behind the lines in Normandy and France, they relaxed and were seen at racecourses and in the pubs of London, West End pubs of London. Criticism was made, evidently, by United States officers and others, that Britain had got plenty of spare officers and they were all lounging about in the hot spots of London. Anyway, when I took over command, I was given orders that I must get them all into action within about 4 weeks, which I did. And they went into action and operated brilliantly and gallantly in different parts of Europe, from Italy to Norway. But when this occurred, I got one letter from a peer who said, my only son and heir is serving under you. I think he has done his job. I just want you to see that he doesn't get killed. And because he is the only heir to my peerage. I wrote back to him and said, I'm certain you must have written this letter in error, and I'm tearing it up, because I'm quite certain that you don't want, on reflection, you don't want me to take any action on this. But it's a aspect of command which certainly I didn't know of. I thought I'd mention it here. Didn't turn it off. No. After the first Wingate operation, we of course relaxed. We were very much underweight. We had dysentery and malaria, and we had to be built up again. I was fortunate in the fact that my sister, whose husband was in Rimi, had a house in Bangalore, and I recovered there and went on leave to Colombo, where I met my brother, who was serving with the plans in Mountbatten's headquarters. I was in Calcutta when I received a message from Wingate to take over the brigade, reform the brigade, and that I would have the temporary rank of colonel.
What date would this approximately be?
What date? I should say it would be about October 1943. And then I was went to Delhi, and I saw various people, and I saw also the GOC&C for Central Command, and my battalion, my brigade was being formed. Now, it was at this stage I convinced General Wingate that we should change the organization of our brigades. Throughout the history of the British Army, there had always been more than three sections in a platoon, three platoons in a company, and three companies in a battalion, three infantry companies in a battalion. But in the First World War, when your flanks on the whole were safe in trench warfare, they started to, because of shortages of officers, I suppose, and to for other reasons, they started to cut down the number of units in each formation. And I said we needed, we should go back to the 4-4-4 formation, because when you attacked, say you were attacking as a platoon, you wanted to have one foot on the ground and attack with three sections. You wanted one foot on the ground because you were carrying heavy packs. You didn't want to go into action carrying heavy packs. And so that it's essential to, the same with a company, they could attack, leave one company on the ground in reserve and attack with one platoon on the ground in reserve and attack with the other three platoons. Same with a battalion, they could have one company protecting signals and all the stores and this, that and the other, and possibly the light plane strip for evacuation, and then still be able to attack three up. And so it was agreed that we should have four battalions to a brigade, and each battalion should have four companies, and we should have four platoons and four sections. This was besides having 3-inch mortars and Bicker machine guns. Now, the battalions could divide into two to make up a column. But I believed in what Napoleon had said, that an army marches in columns, but fights in brigades. And I believed that for penetration and for covering country and for carrying out guerrilla attacks, the column was ideal. But that if we reached any major opposition and we had to fight as a brigade, then the battalions would have to reform and come under the brigade. I practiced this with my brigade in maneuvers so that we could change from battalion to column very quickly, and everybody would know his place and who was in command and so on. This also made much more use of the battalion commander. The snag about the column business was the battalions were left with a sort of spare colonel who had no particular job to do. And this is what happened on the first Wingitching. The colonel of the Gurkhas, Colonel Alexander, just rather wandered around, either with Wingit or with one of the columns, and had no particular authority or job to do. And that is the disadvantage of the column system. So when historians said that we were light brigades, the actual organization of the battalions was heavy. We had Vickers machine guns and mortars, but we didn't, of course, have artillery. But we did have a superb close air support, which Wing Commander Sir Robert Thompson brings out very clearly in his memoirs. The British and Indian armies didn't believe that the Air Force could take the place of artillery, nor did the Air Force. But certainly in Burma, this was so, and we could bomb, and we practiced in India, we could bomb within 50 yards of our own troops perfectly accurately because we had radio sets which would talk from ground to air, and we had RAF detachments with us commanded by an ex-pilot who marched with us and who spoke the same language as the pilots in the air. And the pilots in the air had, because he was a fellow pilot, they had complete trust in him. Result is, he could not only tell us where supplies should be dropped, he could make light plane strips which the light plane pilots would understand, but also when the Mustangs and others, RAF aircraft, came over top, he could talk to them, tell them where the target was, indicate the target by smoke or on an air, a gridded air mosaic, and lead them to the spot to make certain. They could do a dummy run first, and then he could correct them. He would make them, if the conditions of the ground and topography were right, make them bomb in line with our front, so that there were no overs would land amongst our own troops. And we had close air support to within 50 yards of our own troops. And only once did we have casualties from there, when a bomb hung up and went wild and landed amongst our own troops. But this, in 5 months of operations, was a very small example. The obtaining of these pilots and air thing was a great achievement by Wingate. I think I have mentioned already that it wasn't necessarily Wingate's idea to begin with. And air support had been used in places like Mesopotamia and so on between the wars, and on the northwest frontier. But I remind you that I had written my article, The War Office, which is still in the Foreign Office, Operation of Small Forces Behind the Lines, supplied and supported by air. And we had practiced this with Mission 104 to the Australians, and they were the first people to practice it. I had told Wingate this, and it was one of these ideas, and this is why we liked Wingate, which he would question, and then he would bring up all the arguments against it. It is what I believe is Aristotelian debate. And he would oppose your suggestion until you proved it. And then he would adopt it himself. And he took this up to Delhi. And again, we liked Wingate because although most of us had not got that tremendous confidence in our own ideas to fight them through to the bitter end, in Wingate we had a man who would. If he thought an idea was good, he would risk his own career and his own reputation to get that idea through. And fortunately, as I said before, he had this advantage of Air Marshal Earl of Bandon,